love how Skype gives me a notification. Let everyone know that they're being recorded. Why don't you do that? Welcome back to Brothers in Song, everyone. I don't know if George Costanza would think it's too late to wish everyone a Happy New Year at this point, but I'm going to do it anyway. So Happy New Year, everybody. Joe, how late is too late to wish everyone a Happy New Year?
I think I typically give people like a 2-week grace period, but, you know, it's an arbitrary thing. It really doesn't matter. You're just trying to be nice. Jeez. There's a limit for how long you can be nice.
Apparently so. I mean, by the time we've recorded this and by the time I edit it, I mean, we've well passed that 2-week threshold. So in any event, we're just trying to be nice to you listeners. That's all.
That's it.
Give us a break. So before we begin, since this is a new year and we're not too far from our third anniversary of this year's show, I wanted to get some thoughts from you, Joe. What would you say it is that we do here? Have your ideas about the show evolved since we began? What would be your elevator pitch at this point?
Yeah, I like this question because I think it's always good to take a look back and it helps you kind of have a clearer view of looking forward. And so I think we set out to sort of examine a lot more older music and stuff that we had maybe not listened to when it was popular or weren't around when it was popular. And I think, and this is not surprising to me, our creativity has taken hold and we've created a lot more formats and different ways to explore music in all of its forms, and tonight is certainly one of those. And, you know, I think it's really just pointing out sometimes overlooked things that we know, love, and appreciate about music. So that's how I would kind of pitch it to somebody. What about you? Because that's just my perspective, and I'm sure you have yours.
Yeah, I mean, since I have ADHD and I'm often prone to going off on tangents, as listeners of the show will know, elevator pitches are not my specialty, but because those are supposed to take what, 10 seconds?
30 seconds, I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Two things came to mind. When we started the show, I thought one of the hooks in one of the big things that I thought would affect the content is the fact that I learned a lot about music kind of on my own, and you have the formal education. Mm. And while I do think that does influence our individual points of view, it's always interesting to me how we end up drawing many of the same conclusions about what we listen to. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to a couple of things. First of all, there's no right or wrong way to learn about music or become a musician. I mean, people take different paths and learn in all sorts of ways. There's advantages and disadvantages to going out on your own or doing formal training. But I think that shows that, you know, if you love music and you have a musical mind and you have an open mind, that, you know, you will find things that you like that you didn't expect that you like, or, you know, at the very least gain respect for different ways of making music and so forth. So even though our two separate paths have informed the way we look at things in different ways, it's interesting how we always kind of come to the same conclusions and at least come to an understanding about what we're listening to. I think I expected there to be a lot more derision or something.
I can spice it up if you want.
Hey, don't hold back now, Joe.
Yeah.
You know, and then the second thing is that in addition to learning about a variety of musical styles that maybe we wouldn't otherwise, I think we've learned a bunch about each other. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the first time, I'm 5 years older than Joe. And though we did share a lot of music with each other growing up, there was a time where we kind of became musicians separately, you know. And it's been a rewarding experience to learn more about each other along the way. And I think that's absolutely as big a part of the show as anything else we talk about.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, for me, that's most of the fun. I mean, the work leading up to the show and, you know, discovering new music is always fun, but you know, I get the most fun, and this is why we continue to do it. Just having a scheduled time to talk about specific things with you. I mean, we talk about a lot of stuff, but certainly over the last almost 3 years, we've talked more about music than we probably did since we were sharing that small bedroom growing up together.
Yeah, exactly. So it's nice to know that, you know, you can still discover new things about someone you know really well, especially a family member. So we're gonna keep doing it as long as we're having fun doing it, basically. And now, in the interest of doing new stuff, this is our first episode that is going to be talking about a music movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to be talking about the 2014 film Whiplash. And we'll give you a little bit of background before we get started. This is a film that was written and directed by Damien Chazelle.
Chazelle.
Mm-hmm. And it stars J.K. Simmons and Miles Teller. It was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture. It won for editing and sound mixing. Simmons won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. I'm not sure how his role is a supporting role, but I digress. And just to let you all know, this episode is going to be full of spoilers, okay? The movie is 10 years old. And I mean, you're lucky we're giving you a spoiler alert at all. Yeah. But if you were waiting around to watch it, put the podcast on pause. We'll see you back here in a couple of hours, and then you can hear us talk about the movie.
Yeah.
So, Joe, the way we're going to work through this here is we're kind of going to do a little bit of a synopsis and talk about things along the way. We're not going to go beat by beat, but we'll emphasize the major events and ideas. So I'm going to set the scene for everybody, and we'll talk about kind of those opening scenes. So Andrew Neiman, played by Teller, is a first year student. He's a jazz drummer at the prestigious and fictitious Schaefer Conservatory in New York City. He's hoping one day to have a legacy like his idol, jazz drummer Buddy Rich, and Terrence Fletcher, who's played by J.K. Simmons, is the conductor of the conservatory studio band. He sees Andrew playing the drums in a practice room one day, and he recruits him to play in the studio ensemble, where he starts off as second in line to the core drummer. And Andrew quickly discovers that Fletcher is very strict. He's emotionally manipulative. He's abusive to his students. And Andrew is given an opportunity to play on a piece. And now we've come to probably the most famous scene in the movie, which is the, I don't know what people call it. In my mind, I'm calling it the rushing or dragging scene.
Yeah, that's, I think that's appropriate.
Yeah. How would you describe this scene, Joe?
I mean, it's clearly just psychological abuse. I mean, he's singling out players and trying to get them to really sink into his time as the conductor. And he's never going to be happy with the answer. So he has them play the same, you know, three bars over and over again. And ask them, are you rushing or are you dragging? Because they're not on his beat from his perspective. And he, you know, will not stand down, the professor, and he just gets more and more into Andrew's face. And, you know, that's the way it goes, I guess, if you're going to be part of this group. So it's pretty intense, and I think, you know, it's, I think it's kind of incredible the performance J.K. Simmons brings in this, because he is so precise with everything. And I think it's pretty incredible that this is the first movie that Damien Chazelle ever made, and he was pretty young when he did it. And, like, to get that kind of performance out of J.K. Simmons is pretty amazing. But I think this scene is so, is probably the one that sticks out to most people because it's so uncomfortable. Because mm-hmm. I think he has him in there for, like, hours doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that scene? But yeah, it's, I mean, there are hints at him being kind of crazy, but this is where you get, like, the full frontal of it.
Right, right. And I think that this is something that, you know, that character has to establish early on. Like, he has to establish his dominance from the moment
mm-hmm.
that the musicians enter that room, right? And he's got a lot of, I don't want to say leeway, but he feels empowered to do that sort of stuff because just what a scarcity mindset there is for performing artists who, you know, want to be in these prestigious programs. They want the spot in the ensemble. They want the role in the musical, whatever it is, that they will, you know, accept abuse like this because they want that spot so badly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the character of Fletcher, I think, knows and is all too happy to exploit.
One of the, just like the quick takeaways I had is, I think on their first meeting, he says, show up at this place at this time. It's like 6 a.m. in the morning. And of course, like, Andrew sleeps through it. But I got to tell you, certainly as a vocalist, but I think any musician would say this, the early morning practices are fucking dog shit. They're always bad. Like, your mind is not there. Your muscles are not there yet. Like, nothing is, like, and so, like, I never, like, because I had, like, some classes, like, theory classes and stuff at, like, 8 a.m. And there are people in the practice rooms, and I just, like, never understood. It's like, why are you practicing so early? I get the people that were there at, like, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night. I don't get the early morning people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. And in this case, it's just, you know, Fletcher exerting control and manipulation again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Because he shows up, he's late. Andrew is late, and he's all worried about it. But there's nobody there.
Yeah.
But he just sits there waiting. So as we move on in the film here, after that incident, instead of being discouraged, or like, let me get the hell out of here,
mm-hmm.
Andrew intensifies his rehearsing, you know, playing the drums until his hands are just completely blistered and raw.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like kind of the next big scene is they do a set at this jazz competition. You know, Andrew's just kind of along for the ride at this point because he's a freshman. He's behind the other drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew misplaces the core drummer's sheet music. And that character, his name's Tanner, he can't play without the sheets, but Andrew is able to replace him because he can do it from memory. I really like how this scene was filmed, because you can see Andrew clearly place the sheet music on a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then does he go to a vending machine? I think he goes to a vending machine.
Yeah. They like do something just turns to take around. His attention for not even 30 seconds, but yeah.
Right. And then Tanner, the other drummer, comes and asks Andrew, okay, I need to see the sheets. And we look at the chair and the sheets are gone. But I do like how they kind of leave that ambiguous.
Yeah.
So, you know, Andrew gets his shot. He's able to play the piece by memory. And, you know, Andrew is now in the top spot. So they go to another competition. And, you know, all the musicians are responsible for getting to the venue. Andrew's bus gets a flat tire.
Mm-hmm.
He runs to rent a car. But he gets to the competition late, and he forgot his sticks in the rental car office. Fletcher is obviously pissed off. And Andrew convinces Fletcher to give him the time to like rush back and get the sticks. So on his way back to the venue after retrieving the sticks, Andrew's car is hit by a truck. And he pulls himself out of the wreckage, makes his way to the theater. He's covered in blood, looks like hell. It's obviously very difficult to play after you've been in a car accident. And basically in the middle of a piece, I think, Fletcher stops everything and dismisses Andrew from the band. And then Andrew attacks Fletcher on stage, which leads to his expulsion from the conservatory. So again, a lot of intense stuff. What were you thinking about when this whole thing was going on?
So there, I think this is meant to be the climax of the movie, I think, in some ways. And there's still some other stuff that happens to kind of round out the shape of the narrative. But I think there's a couple of things that, like, questions I had that it's kind of like, this just does not seem plausible by any stretch of the imagination. Like, one, if you're going anywhere in college, you're not going by yourself unless there's a real reason why. Like, that's just not how it works. Like, everybody hangs out together. If you're in a group or if you're, like, so I don't understand how he's on the bus by himself. Then, I don't understand how this guy who's, like, obsessed with being this, you know, amazing musician would ever leave his instrument, i.e. his sticks, anywhere. That seems like that would never happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the last part is, you know, of him attacking him. I actually think that is possible. I don't know if it would happen. I don't know if it would happen in the middle of a competition, more like in the previous rehearsal when he's making him play for 5 hours straight. I could see him kind of snapping then and, like, you know, potentially, you know, trying to do some physical harm to the professor. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's an intense moment, you know, and though he's been, you know, dedicating everything, you know, ignoring his family, ignoring his, you know, girlfriend, it all comes crashing down despite his best efforts.
I think in a real life scenario, I'm not sure about Fletcher the character, but I think in a real life scenario, a control freak like Fletcher, like wouldn't allow the group or the individuals in the group to make their way to the competition. You know, and like you say, you know, in college, stuff like that, you're probably all traveling together anyway, or like carpooling at the very mm-hmm. least. I don't know. This is supposed to be a prestigious conservatory. I can't see them just like allowing the kids to just like
make, schlep there.
Yeah. Why don't you schlep this? Well, actually, that begs another question. He's on a bus. He's got his sticks with him, but where's the drum set? Like, how did the drum set get there?
Where's the kit? Yeah, they must just have one at the venue, I guess.
I don't know about that. I mean, they could have a drum set at the, but like drum sets are so, I don't know, they're so particular to that individual. That doesn't seem right either.
Yeah.
But yeah, those kind of details aside, I mean, I feel like there are a lot of things in the movie that could happen, but maybe not plausibly happen. But I think the whole point is this, are the kind of like the overarching themes that are being exaggerated by the mm-hmm. events. You know, so, and I think ultimately when Andrew attacks Fletcher, obviously there's been a buildup to that, like all the abuse, and he finally snaps. But I think even like big picture stuff, you know, no matter how talented you are as a performing artist, you know, a lot of the time your fate and your career are in the hands of like a couple assholes. Who, yeah. You know, yeah. Who either like you, don't like you for whatever reason, you know, and it all seems pretty arbitrary sometimes. And it's natural to feel a lot of bitterness about that and resentment. And I think in that scenario, like Fletcher almost represents the institution of like the gatekeepers in performing arts or something like that.
I mean, you're right about that. There certainly are gatekeepers. And What's interesting to me is like his entire tactical approach to trying to get like the best out of people, as mm-hmm. he so claims, is like the intense yelling and screaming. I don't know how that could manifest itself into being like motivational in any way, because like playing music, yes, there's some physical effort involved with it, but having like more effort is not going to make you play better.
Mm-hmm.
Where like if it's like a sport, like, well, if I yell at you, you'll run faster, you know, because you're angry and you're going to like put more energy into it and that will make you better. That's not really the case with being a musician. And you see it, right? Because Andrew just tries to practice harder and harder and harder, and it's not really making him any better. At least not from my perspective in watching the movie, because better in something that is totally subjective is really just the perception of who is, you know, assigning the grade to it. So, I don't know. I don't really know why he was doing all that, except it's just like power, control, and I can make this happen or not happen for you with like one phone call.
Right. Well, and that's kind of the point. It's like the point is to have that power. Like Fletcher has found his niche and he's ruler over this fiefdom, and he's going to make sure that everybody knows it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a good teacher.
No.
You know, so the yelling, whether the yelling or screaming is effective, like, I don't think that matters to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the reputation of the school, which he's just using that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he's going to get, you know, highly dedicated musicians. And even though he is ostensibly a teacher, like he doesn't really have to teach them because they already know what they're doing, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, that kind of leads us to our epilogue. I feel like this portion mm-hmm. of the movie serves as an epilogue. In the next scene, you know, it's Andrew who comes upon Fletcher, who has apparently left the conservatory, and he's playing piano in a jazz band. You know, it should be noted that Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons are both musicians, and they're both really playing a lot of this stuff, which I appreciate.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because they could have cast anybody and faked it, and I think it would have been a distraction in this particular movie.
Yeah, I 100% agree on that.
But all that aside, you know, so they kind of have a drink and seemingly, you know, clear the air, and Fletcher invites Andrew to play in this other jazz ensemble he's conducting, and he assures him that that he knows the repertoire. And before the first piece begins, Fletcher kind of whispers to Andrew that, like, he knows it was Andrew that, like, filed complaints to get him fired from the conservatory and so on. So, as revenge, Fletcher leads the band into a song that Andrew does not know and was mm-hmm. not provided the sheet music for.
Yeah.
So, that's a disaster. Andrew starts to walk off stage. His father tries to console him, But then Andrew turns right around, goes back to the stage, retakes the drum kit, and kind of interrupts whatever little spiel Fletcher was doing for the audience. And he just starts playing the drum intro to the song Caravan, which was featured earlier in the movie. And the band sort of follows along, because here we are now with everybody's ass hanging out on stage. so you gotta like kind of make like it's working. And initially Fletcher is angry, but then he resumes conducting, and as the piece finishes, Andrew continues into a very extended solo. I don't know, Andrew and Fletcher seem to like lock eyes, like they've kind of like reached this stalemate at this point, and then the movie just kind of ends with a blackout.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but like I was I don't know why, but I was like I was suckered into believing that, like, I don't know, maybe Fletcher had gone to anger management, he'd been to counseling, he was going to bury the hatchet, and I was like, okay, I wonder what's going to happen here. And it was total, you know, deception, and again, an effort to humiliate and embarrass Andrew. But like, what did you think of all that? I feel like there must be some, you know, extended meaning to that whole ending confrontation. But I'm not sure that I've decided what I think it is yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting way to end the movie, because I think you could have ended it, you know, with something like a little bit more saccharine, you know, maybe, you know, you flash forward and Andrew's teaching, you know, high school band or something like that, or, you know, maybe he's just playing in a jazz quartet at, you know, a spot in New York City and, you know, having a perfectly nice life. But to then have them have one more sort of interaction was interesting, because I think, you know, it doesn't say it explicitly, but in the movie, I think you're led to believe it's, you know, been several months, if not longer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both sort of in a different place. So to see them, like, come back together, Andrew being a little bit more mature, and Fletcher being maybe a little bit toned down, that he's been knocked down a peg. There's still like a lot of tension and like deviance in their scene together, but it's very different from the rest of the movie. And I think it's part of that, like, that time has passed, the characters have evolved, but still they are who they are at their core.
Right. Yeah. In a certain way, it's like, you know, Fletcher still wants that control, and you have to figure at some point in Andrew's musical upbringing, there was ingrained in him like this reverence for the music director, and so he still has like that instinct to please.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what that's about, you know, like that, I don't know, eternal struggle, I don't know what you want to call it.
I think
that dynamic that happens in music departments all over the place.
Yeah. Well, and I think like anytime there's that hierarchical structure, whether it's school or work or wherever, I think it's very hard to shift the perception of somebody from where you were like as a student day one to, well, you know, I've been doing this for a long time now, I'm not a kid anymore type of attitude. And, you know, that's the way that I mean, I feel like Fletcher is always going to see like the nervous kid that was in the practice room in Andrew's first scene, no matter how accomplished he becomes.
with kind of the story out of the way, mm-hmm. and a little bit of analysis of each scene, I'm curious to know, you know, what did you think of it as a movie? Like, how it was put together? Did you enjoy it? You know, what did you think about that?
I thought it was interesting. There's certainly a lot of details that I appreciated of being, like, exactly right. Like, when, whether it was, you know, when conductors do, like, spot checks on stuff, that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And, like, you see, like, the real, like, anxiety in that room when he starts to do that. And, you know, oh, can you turn my page for me? Like, that's also, like, an anxiety-inducing experience. Like,
yeah, weirdly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not a fun job. But actually, like, one of my favorite scenes that we didn't really touch on, but I think is, like, a really important scene for what the movie is trying to, the message that the movie is trying to tell you, is the dinner scene with his family. And it's so clear at that point that he, if he wasn't before, he certainly is now, like, absolutely obsessed with just being the best. And he's pretty kind of rude to his family members.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'd rather be great and have people talk about me and die young than to just live, like, a pretty normal average life and be totally forgotten. Which is basically like a comment on his father, his brothers, etc. Yeah. So, you know, so back to your question, like, I liked how they depicted that, because I think that there is a lot of truth in that, and it's more complex than just this person's an asshole. And sometimes, like, just everyday people who are experiencing art, like, may not always understand the toil that goes through into creating it.
Yeah.
And that's why, like it really, I mean, this probably sounds cliche, but, like, when people create art, it is a gift, because, like, it's a piece of them that they're, like, sharing with the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see the, like, the positive side of that, but this certainly looks at the other side of that and how it really can change a person, just that, like, obsession of being great and creating great music. So, I don't know if I need to really watch it again, but I thought that the performances were really great. And again, like, as a first time film for Damien Chazelle, it was pretty incredible. But yeah. What about you? 'Cause, like, again, this is, we watched it together. It was the first time either of us had seen it, which is kind of incredible that neither of us really, like, got curious enough to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts, like, on the film? And obviously, like, it goes without saying, like, the soundtrack throughout is pretty great just to, like, listen to.
Yeah. And as a person who really enjoys jazz, I liked that aspect of it. Like, that was just nice for me because I mm-hmm. like it. And I think as a movie, it was really well put together. Like, I understand why it won that Oscar for editing, and you know, and I like how the story was told. And I think that, you know, that kind of movie could end up being, like, heavy-handed and moralistic and didactic and just, you know, really, like, hit you over the head with a lesson, but this one doesn't. It definitely leaves room for you to ponder what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it did a good job of presenting a lot of big ideas about music and the arts that I kind of think about a lot. Art as commodity and art as competition, and how we can't seem to view, you know, music or cooking or any number of creative pursuits outside of this competition framework, you know? And so I think it has a lot to say about that. And I think your dinner scene that you mentioned, it's a short scene, but it says a lot. And it's interesting how they're like comparing, well, the brothers are comparing like the music and versus sports, which I think gets, you know, the arts and athletics tend to butt heads a lot, but I actually kind of wish they wouldn't, because I think they're both important parts of being a human. I like how that scene kind of like encapsulates that that sort of rivalry. And and it did actually, you know, remind me of some of my own experiences in the performing arts. I mean, nothing like chair throwing, but definitely screaming. Yeah. I without naming names, I mean, I think you know who I'm talking about. Like people who we've been in contact with who are screaming at people, throwing people out of practice and things like that for really like stupid reasons. Like they're so stupid, I can't even remember what happened. You know what I mean? I can't even remember why this person, you know, why these people were thrown out or whatever. You know, and there's people in community theater, which I've been a part of, who've been like that. Like I've seen directors just reaming people out, and it's like, the fuck are you doing, man? Like, you gotta, you know, are we here to express something and like bring people together, or like, you know, on our own time, on our volunteer time?
It was probably a really eye-opening movie for people who maybe haven't had some of the experiences that you and I have had. And I think like in a similar way that certain movies about like, you know, like the restaurant world or, you know, any other like highly competitive, highly intense, like career path or profession. And if you're not part of it, like you don't realize again, like what people go through to be at the pinnacle of those things.
Right.
And I think like this movie does like a really good job of really, for the most part, with the handful of the exceptions I think we noted, does a really good job of really shining a light on that. And I think that's from Damien Chazelle's like personal experience, because it is based on somebody who, Fletcher is based on somebody that was like in his life at one point. So he probably wanted to just tell that story because he had his own sort of issues with trying to work through it on a personal level.
Right. You know, and as a final thought, and as someone who's done the majority of any kind of performing I've done for free, you know, on a volunteer basis, which is totally fine. And I'm totally comfortable with that. It's like, I feel like there's gotta be a balance. Like you're there to express something. Presumably it's something you enjoy. Presumably you want the audience to enjoy it or take something away from it and be immersed in it for whatever period of time. If you're going to spend all those hours, days, weeks putting something together, then yes, please, let's take this seriously and be on time and put forth our best effort and be prepared and all that stuff. And also at the same time, let's have fun and derive some enjoyment from it. Like, let's not suck all the joy out of, you know, music and arts, because it's there to be. It's even when it's there to teach you something or to make you feel a little bit uncomfortable, it's there to be enjoyed and make you feel something, you know?
Right.
So that's always been my attitude about making this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know, as someone who's been in a conservatory, like you may have a different perspective on that, but that's how I feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, with my limited sort of professional experience, I certainly think having that perspective and living that type of life, it was hard because you're just like, well, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? I have to get into this type of program or that type of program, or what kind of roles do I have in my resume? And then it does start to feel like work, because it is work. And then you kind of lose a little bit of the joy that comes with creating it. And, and I think that's just how you have to be if you want to be successful. And I certainly had very low levels of success as a professional musician, but, you know, that was like a really, I don't know, it was so long ago, it's hard to kind of articulate it. But, I think as you go along, you realize like, yeah, I want to do this because I love doing it. But maybe I can still love doing it without it being like the only thing that I do.
Right. And, you know, and I honestly wish more people felt free to do that, you know, with whatever kind of creativity mm-hmm. you're doing. You know, and you don't even have to show it to anybody. Like, just do it. Start off by doing it for your own enjoyment. I think a lot of people lose that because they feel like, well, I'm not good enough to do X, mm-hmm. Y, or Z, so why should I even bother?
Right.
And that, my friends, is bullshit. Just do what you want to do.
Yeah.
So with that, any other final thoughts on this one, Joe?
No, I thought this was a good idea, and I'm sure there's other things we could tackle that would fall into this category of how, you know, music, telling stories through music certainly happens via, you know, albums and operas and musicals, but it also happens in film too, which, music plays a big part of a lot of films, but to have this opportunity to examine a film about making music and having all the musical elements in it was a fun thing to do, and certainly different and not anything we would have thought of after episode one, because we were like, we have a format, we have a structure that we're going to adhere to, and now we just kind of do what we want to do, which I think is exactly what we were just talking about.
Yeah, pretty much. Thanks for listening, everybody. We definitely have some new ideas for the coming year. You may get to meet additional family members.
It's possible.
We're working on that. Some other guests who may join us. But until then, we appreciate you and thanks for listening.
Take care.
Brothers in Song is written and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin, and edited by Daniel Collin. To keep up with the latest news, follow us on Instagram at Brothers in Song. Until next time, listen to some new music. You just may surprise yourself.